So the title of the talk is We Can't Stop Trying to Control the Wind. And I want to just start with the kind of deeply existential problem of being born in a body, which is hard work. Life is insecure. It passes by, and it has no protector. And the Buddha said that. So there's some authority there. But we know that. There's no protection underneath. We're born in a body and we go again. There's nothing that we can guarantee, the ground that says we're protected. So we try and so hard to be safe and to be comfortable and things to be better, and we want things to be sorted out. But we actually can't do it. So the Dharma teaching of this is called the Eight Worldly Winds. And that's the title, why the title of the talk. Winds of the world, ruchot, the winds of the world. And the winds of the world are affecting all beings, humans or others, that are born in a body. We're all affected by the winds, and they're the winds that take us to pieces, that we want to, there's a struggle. There's our struggle. So two winds are gaining and losing. We want to gain, we don't want to lose. We want to have possessions, we want to have health, we want to have life. We don't want to lose our things, we'd lose our life, lose our health, lose our relationship. So gain and loss is two. Acceptance and rejection is another two. We want to be accepted. We're part of a community. We want to belong. We don't like to be cut off, isolated, lonely. The third pair is praise and blame. It's also of ourselves. We want to feel good with ourselves. It's the feeling of being successful, of being good with ourselves, of feeling worth something and not feeling down and having a low image of ourselves, and or other people having low image of us. Every ant wants people to like it. And the third is pain or happiness. And we want to be happy. We don't want to be unhappy. So these are the worldly winds, and we are busy with them all our life. And the reason that we are busy with them is that, just as the Buddha said, our life is totally dependent. We are not standing separate from anything. We are totally dependent. We can't exist without water, without food, without love, without earth, without trees, without nature, without other people, we're dependent. And so we have moments when we are feeling really contented and feeling really okay, when everything's okay. And it's just for a moment. And then dukkha appears. Because we're dependent, because we're not a self-existing thing that's isolated from everything. We are totally part of everything, so we're dependent on everything. So we can feel comfortable, everything in place, we're healthy, we're well, we have wonderful supper like just now, a wonderful lunch, and wonderful meditation, and everything's going great, and it's wonderful, and then, oh, dukkha, up it comes. Temporary. Contentment. Sviut ratson. contentment is temporary. And because of that, we get really, really busy in our life trying to control things so that we stay contented and keeping these winds satisfied, controlling the winds of worldly winds. Quite recently, I understood that the kind of modern definition of consciousness, that means the whole of arising of consciousness in us, is the service of this being comfortable. And the way they define consciousness today in the neurological, you know, brain science is predictive processing, meaning we need to understand what might happen, to take care that we're all right, to take care that we are, to process the world so that we're safe, that it's a mechanism for simply processing and predicting, this I do, if I do this, I'll be okay. If I don't do this, I will not be okay. So the whole of consciousness is at the service of this busyness of controlling, so that the worldly winds don't blow through us. So we need to look at that carefully. And that what happened to the Buddha when he was in that situation, he went out at night. He couldn't believe quite the truth that he was told, which is, you're a prince in a beautiful palace, you have everything you need, you have nothing to think about, there's no suffering that exists, there's no pain, there's everything is great, and so on. He didn't quite believe it. So he went out at night and he saw suffering. And that was his wake-up call. They were the divine messengers. They're called divine messengers. Messengers are shlichim shmeimim, a poor person, a sick person, a dead body, and a monk. And so we can look at this situation and say, wait a minute, I have to wake up from this. I'm not going to live like that. And that's the power of dukkha, of the worldly winds, that they wake us up. We say, wait a minute, I'm not prepared to live like that. One year in Kleel, with rockets going over, we're 12 kilometers from Lebanon, and we haven't left Kleel the whole time we were there. And booms and bangs all day. And my granddaughter reminded me, take every boom and bang as a Zen master stick to remind you to wake up. And it's a beautiful message. You know, insecurity, violence, uncertainty, dependence, pain, suffering. Wake up. So the message of waking up is a bit scary, because does it ask us to stop controlling things? Because if we're so busy with control, the pressure to control, and there's a lot of pain in that, the pressure to control, the shlot. So do we have to stop trying to control? That's scary. Do I not go to the doctor if I'm sick? I just say, no, it's a wake-up call. I can stay here, be sick. No, we go to the doctor, of course. The Buddha had a doctor. Why not? But what happens is we begin to know that we can let go more and more of the pressure to control. And we do it bit by bit. And every time we let go of pressure to control, something opens us and we find benefit and freedom. Bit by bit, we let go a bit of the pressure to control and we see something else arising in its place. And that is the balance. And there is our practice. I remember a book I read by Trayo Wilbur, who called Grace and Grit. It's a lovely book. It's Ken Wilbur's wife that died of cancer in the end. But on the journey, she wrote a book about her relationship with cancer. And at one point she was saying, I really, really know the benefit of surrender and just allowing the situation to be as it is. And it really helped me live well. But then I realized that actually it was making me a bit passive. And I wasn't active enough in looking after myself. I needed to have the will to live. I couldn't be too much kind of into the meditation space of surrender. I needed the will to live. But if the will to live was too strong, I kept bringing the doctor and worrying about symptoms. And the answer for me, she said, is to take this whole thing very lightly, not to let go too much and not to care about it, but also not to be busy with control too much and find a kind of middle way which is respectful to life. So what's instead of control? Actually, everything. Because if we let go a bit of the need to control and we open our consciousness to our relationship with existence, instead of the need to control existence, we develop intimacy with existence. We are in relationship with everything. And all of a sudden, we're in another place completely. We're not standing here, I need to control what happens and get it better and get it and be busy and make sure I'm comfortable and make sure, you know, the, keep maintaining the izor nochut, the comfort zone. I can find myself in intimate relationship with everything. And the Dharma takes us there very much in that place, the intimacy, the interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. We find ourselves in intimate relationship with life. And that flow is really different. Spirituality is relational. It's not us as a separate unit trying to find awakening. It's always about relationship. It's relationship. In fact, the Buddha said you can't do this on your own. You can't awaken on your own. You need Sangha. You need others. You need conditioning. You need Shoshelet, all the yogis from the past. You need, you're in relation to, you can't, you're not a box. If you're in a box, you'll suffer. You won't, you can't do it on your own. So this different view of our relationship, our relational view, is a difference from the control view. Because the control view is us in some way against life, having to fix life. Again, don't misunderstand me. Of course we go to the doctor. Of course we look after ourselves. Of course we get food. But with what attitude do we do that? So there, this, instead of the pressure to control, we let life go through us. Life is happening through us. Life is lived through us. And we begin to find the joy of dancing with the winds, with the worldly winds, the winds that we can't control. We dance with the uncontrollable. Instead of fighting it to try and control it, we dance with it. And it's the classic view of, Taoism, for example, expresses it beautifully. The Tao Te Ching. There's a very nice story I like about that. A man standing on a bridge and he's watching a waterfall. And he sees an old man coming up a path with his stick. And all of a sudden, the old man comes to the waterfall and jumps in. And the man on the bridge said, "Oh my God, he wants to kill himself. I have to rescue him." Runs down to the waterfall. But all of a sudden, he sees the old man coming out of the waterfall on the other side. And he's shocked. He survived. He went to the old man. He said, "How do you survive that huge waterfall?" The old man said, "I have no idea. The water went like this and like this. And I went like this and like this. And I found myself on the other side." A place there of non-control is a place that gives us so much flow with life, dance with life. I was very impressed with one old-time practitioner that I'm connected with, and he comes again and again. And he's in a wheelchair. He's a young guy, had a motorbike accident. And he had 2 years when he was totally depressed and miserable and was suicidal after the accident. And then one day he said, "I can no longer. I have to wake up from this. I can no longer go with this misery. I just have to say, now is all there is. I allow myself to be as I am right now. There is no other way to live." And from that moment, life changed for him totally. And now he teaches meditation and he's in really a good shape. Some of you know him. He's really inquiring and open and lovely guy to be with. So we're not trying to do something artificially here. We're not trying to create illusion, chasing the rainbow of another form of everything's okay. It's not the truth of things. It's that we're affected by the worldly winds and life is fragile and we need to wake up and not just to suffer. So there's a truth in that. And the way the Buddha taught is to unfold the truth of things. He didn't teach idealism. If we just believe in the beyond, I know that lots and lots of Buddhists say next life. Okay, this life is shit. Wait for the next one. It'll all work out, the next one and the next one and the next one. We can't wait for that. We don't have time for that. And there's illusion in that. I really like in the Zohar. Zohar says about Olam Haba, which is very much the Jewish version of future lives. And in the Zohar, it says the Olam Haba is the Olam Sheba B'Kol Rega. So we need that now. truth of things now. What is it we experience now? And we meet things as they are, including the fact that we cannot control life. Life controls us. And when we meet it fully, there is a relief in that. We let go of the pressure to be serving control all our life. There's a nice image. It's this one. So the Buddha went round the villages for his lunch. And it was absolutely crucial for him and all the monks that they did not ask for anything special. They didn't choose. They didn't say, only rice again? But I had only rice yesterday. Come on. That's why the Buddha wasn't a vegetarian. Because he was basically the Buddha and all the monks were eating the stuff that goes to the compost. They were eating what the families threw out. And it was important for them because it was more important to eat what was thrown out than to be, say, I want to control. I want this or not this. This one is better. This one is good. This one is not good. It was more important that whatever came in the bowl is right. And our mind is a bit like the Buddha's bowl. We need to allow whatever comes in the mind, that's it. And it helps us to move more lightly through the world without constant preference, choice, need, control, better, not better, this one, predictive processing, to have consciousness which is just open and relational and not trying to process things to be better. And from there, we have the definition of awakening, which is simply tat, meaning that. So when awakening, the only thing you can say about reality after that is that. The Buddha called himself Tathagata, meaning I've gone to that. There isn't anything else you can say about life. It's that. It just is. So he called himself that, which is lovely. Tat. Or kahut in the, I think, that's a word in Hebrew going around. That. And in Sanskrit, sat. And if the ultimate reality in Sanskrit is Satchitananda, which the first is Sat, and Chit is awareness that knows that. And Ananda is the joy that comes when you just live with that. So you can't define life anymore, and you can't kind of, once you let go of the need, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. It just is that. So I can imagine that some of you are thinking, okay, all that sounds very unrealistic. Meanwhile, there's a war going on right now. And meanwhile, there's amazing and terrible suffering going on. And so how does it relate to something like that? And it's true. There is immense pain going on, and we all feel it, and we all feel touched, we all feel hurt, we all feel wounded by what's going on, we all feel often confused and agitated, and we try and do things about it, and we get exhausted, we get burnt out, or we feel helpless. So lots and lots of stuff, we despair, lots of things coming out of that. And we have a look at our relationship to suffering like that, in the world we live in. And we see that we're built a kind of self out of it. We built story out of it. And that's giving us all the anger, the despair, the misery that we feel about things that are beyond us, that we cannot control, that are too strong for us. We have no control over what's going on. The suffering continues. How can we look at it differently? And the basic difference is we call it by its true name. We do not hide anything or cover it over or try and even say there'll be hope and it'll be better. And we don't know. We call it by its true name. We look at it directly in the eyes. This is what's happening now in our relational world, our world of relationships. This is what we see, this tragedy. We call it the tragedy and we cry if we need to cry. But at the same time, we understand that this tragedy is happening because of so many conditions that we cannot change. We did not do this. We did not make this. There are many, many, many conditions that we cannot control, that we are. And if we try and control it, we just suffer more. So we need to see the causes and conditions are bigger than us. We need to be a free person, knowing the pain, and then respond in relationship with it. And as a free person, not under despair and helplessness and all that stuff based on control and not being able to control and the struggle. Instead of that, we are become a free person going to help where we can. And we, by calling things by their true name, by a sense of being not in charge, not in control, but what I can do is I can contribute something. I can give. And this is about offering ourselves and not about controlling. And it comes from a relational understanding our relation, our interbeing. Us and them are one. We are one with Palestinians, Israelis. We are one. We are the same. We are in the same, all in the same boat. We're all the same. We all want to live. We're all affected by the worldly winds. We are the same. So from there, compassion arises. We're in the now. We help where we can. We help wherever we can feel suffering, wherever we're invited to help, wherever we can see that there's something we can do, we go and help. But from a place of, not a place of control and struggle and exhaustion and despair. So responsibility in this place is responsibility, meaning yicholit lagiv. It's not about having on my shoulders, not carrying everything, the world on my shoulders, that all I want to do after that is just go, it's kind of watch movies, I don't know, switch off. Responsibility is developing ability to respond, and we do that by seeing things directly and relating directly. It is like it is. Just like the guy who's in a wheelchair. In the end, all I can say is, it is as it is. Now I start. There's something a little bit similar in the Bhagavad Gita that you probably know, that Arjuna was faced with this also impossible situation of a war with his own family on one, two different sides. And he started from a place of wanting to control and struggle and being helpless and not being able to do anything. And he asked Krishna, well, I can't deal with this. This is too much. How can I fight this battle? And Krishna said, look, it's not you that did it. Life, karma, put you on this side and them on the other side and fighting a war. You didn't do it. Just do the best you can, because it's not in your hands. And I think maybe in India they took karma a little bit too much, too far. And there's a little bit too much fatalism there, that we can't do anything about it. Karma is just... But I think it's a bit of a misunderstanding of karma. Karma is simply the whole vast net of causes and conditions that create this moment. And karma also tells you that you can change things, that you can make difference in the world, because you're a cause and condition as well. What you act, every word from the karma point of view, it goes into the world and does something. Everything is affecting everything else. Because of this relational interbeing, then nothing is lost. Everything you do goes somewhere. That's also karma. So it's actually not fatalistic. It also has the opposite. It says we have a power to change things because nothing is lost. Everything makes waves. So you can look at it in different ways, but in the Bhagavad Gita, the Krishna said, you know, who you think you are? You're not in charge of this. This is what's happened. All you can do is do what you need to do. But I think that if we, in real practical terms, if we carry less need to control and pressure and need to fix things, and we feel more steady and balanced and open and quiet, we can actually make more difference in the world, including in a situation of war. I'm thinking of, for example, someone like Nelson Mandela, who was a huge figure, and he changed the whole country. But he had a lot of quietness and listening, and he spent 26 years in prison. And my guess is one long Vipassana retreat that he did in South Africa on the island. But I don't know really. And he came out of that 26 years in prison with a real kind of a wisdom of listening, of quiet, of allowing, of not being struggling this against that with the conflict and with this and trying to just kind of a big person. Not busy with attachment. It's got to be like this. My views, my... So how do we... a few words about how we practice. We've talked a lot about this already, but I will add some more guidelines about practicing to kind of move ourselves to dancing with the unexpected and the uncontrollable. To dance with the winds, to be the Taoist, to be the man in the waterfall that just goes like that and finds himself on the other side, quite safe and happy. So the first thing, which is express anicca in another way, to understand that everything is dynamic and flexible. And we put together our experience from all. We make, you know, we put all the pieces. All the vegetables go in the soup. And we boil the soup and we have a great soup called me. We design, design is not the word. We put together our experience. We are constantly constructing our world. Our world isn't a given, ready-made, and then we'd suffer because we're not in control. The world is as we make it. We build our world. We construct our views. We construct our thoughts. We construct ourselves. The word for self and Asaf said it yesterday. Bhava is making a self. Bhava is building, becoming. The word in English would be becoming. We're becoming somebody. So every time something happens to us, we become, we build another self from those conditions and so on. The self that we, I was joking before lunch here, and there was a lunch, I was ringing the bell for lunch. And when the lunch bell rang, suddenly we are all in a different place. Oh, lunch. And all the dramas disappeared, I'm sure, if you had them. And lunch came instead. So we built another person, a lunch-eating person, and not a person full of dramas. We're in a different place. In just one moment, one ring of the bell, we're already different. We build ourselves, we become all the time, we get shaped by circumstances. We are shaped by nesibot, by things happening to us. And we need to just allow that experience arrives, and we build responses and we build stories and we build a self out of it. If we see that, it's very dynamic. It's very flexible. Everything is flexible. There's nothing given and stuck. That's the positive side of the fact of life being passing and not having substance. The shavrirut, the positive side of shavrirut is flexibility. Gemishut. So we are building ourselves. We can build ourselves in many ways. Every moment we're building our world. We're making this thought. We're making this understanding, this perception, this way of looking, this way of being, this person. So part of that dynamic is to see experience as visitors arriving. A thought arrives, appears, turns up. And aleinu, on us to say welcome, to allow experience. That's the way of dancing with the unexpected or the uncontrollable. Allowing experience to be what it is, to give it space, to give it permission, to be surprised. Wow, where did that come from? How many of you kind of had a thought that arrives unexpectedly in the middle of meditation? Where did you come from? A second place of, I would say, practice is to give space to things, give respect to things. I like the English word respect because it means to look again. Re-spec. Spec is to look and re is again. To give a second look. Not to take things as automatically. Give space to something. There's a Zen story about anger where a student came to his teacher and said, I'm all the time, I have anger as a habit. Please help me to deal with it. And the teacher said, okay, bring the anger and we'll deal with it. And the student said, yeah, okay, but I don't have anger right now. So the teacher said, so when you do have anger, bring it and we'll deal with it. So the student said, well, look, it takes 10 minutes for me to come from my room to your room. And during this time, the anger for sure will have gone. So the teacher said, you see, even if you want anger, you can't get it. It doesn't come, it's not yours. It comes from the universe. You can't design anger. It comes from the world. It's your reactivity. It happens when it needs to, by triggers. So it gives space to things, gives a big mind that sees the respect, give space, give respect, give interest to what arises. I was talking about this some time back, as respect is actually seeing the elephant in the room, meaning looking and seeing what's underneath or what's hidden. And actually, you to begin to see the elephant. The elephant can be something a bit hidden and subconscious or not clear. And our practice is bringing clarity, looking at things more clearly. Okay, you are like that. Welcome. Hello, I see you. But someone said wisely, if you see the elephant in the room, you also see the room. And I hadn't thought about it, but it's a lovely image. It's true. If you see the elephant, you also see the room. You also see the space, the non-elephant. You need to see the elephant to see what is not elephant. You need to see a thought is one way to see what is not thought, what is between thoughts or behind thought or consciousness which is not a thought. To see a thought, you begin to see consciousness. And it's formless, non-form. So give space to things. Look, stay with things. Look more deeply. And it doesn't really matter what it is. Whatever's coming up is good enough. It can be a fly on the nose. Can be the big dramas, it can be something small, it can be the joy of walking outside, it can be anything, but give it space, give it interest, stay with it. And things change when you look at them carefully. For example, in the end, every emotion is built on love. But we don't notice it because an emotion like anger is built on protection. So we respond to threat with anger and it's automatic. But underneath there is love. Why? Because we are connecting to the world, but up jumps the shirion, shelanu, the protection, the shield. But nevertheless, we are there with the world, we see the world, we are with the world, we are connected. All emotions are about the heart being with the world, being in the world. We can see that. We can see what's underneath emotion if we see things less personally. Less personal, all emotion becomes connection. I want to read a poem from Rumi. Which is going in this direction. In every breath, if you are the center of your own desires, you'll lose the grace of the divine. But if in every breath you blow away your self-importance, the ecstasy of love will arrive. In every breath, if you are the center of your own thoughts, the sadness of autumn will fall on you. But if in every breath you strip naked, just like in winter, the joy of spring will grow from inside. All impatience comes from pushing for wanting and for needs. Let go of the struggle and peace will arrive. Another place of, I would say, direction of practice, which is to be with the, we talked about uncontrollable, life being uncontrollable. It's helpful for us to allow things to be unknown, not so clear, not so known. It's really fine to ask a question. Is it really like that? So a thought comes, a feeling comes, an experience comes. Is it like that? A drama, a pattern in the mind. Who are you? Is it really so? A conclusion, a thought, a view of reality, a construction that we make. Is it really so? It's quite good to have an atmosphere of questioning, especially in relation to the self. Without, again, pressure or conflict, but just have in the background a sense of query. What's really happening right now? That's using our awareness, our mind, in a wise way. We have a great mind, all of us. We don't need to shut it down and just breathe. We can use the mind as well. And a way, good way to use the mind is just see it as in the background, kind of open question, what's really happening? When the Buddha was asked, is there a self? He was silent. And so the person asking him said, so you mean there's no self? And he was silent. And so the monks around said, why didn't you answer? And the Buddha said, whatever I would say would be taken in the wrong way. If I said there was a self, it would be taken as a view of existence, of permanent existence of things, which is not true. If I said there's no self, it would be taken as a view of nothingness. Or the person might have said, it's all a bit confusing. It might mean, the Buddha must mean there was a self and now there isn't. Although I wasn't a self and now I am. I have no idea what he's talking about. So the Buddha said nothing. It's better to leave it as a question. And the question is really, that's the right kind of question that we that can stay with us. And it points us to the unknown. It points us to the less known. There is a very lovely sutta that I love. I'll actually quote it. Someone asked the Buddha, how do you recognize an enlightened person? And the Buddha said, it's just like a flame that is struck by a sudden gust of wind. In a flash, it's gone out, and nothing more can be known about it. And it's the same with an enlightened person freed from mental existence. In a flash, he's gone out, and nothing more can be known about him. So, in other words, the Buddha says in different translation, you recognize an enlightened person because you can't find them. You're looking straight at them, but you can't see them. And so the student said, well, I don't understand. Please explain. You know the way things work. Has the man disappeared? Does he not exist? Or is he in some other state of permanent well-being like a god? No, said the Buddha, when a person has gone out, then there is nothing by which you can measure him or her. That by which he can be talked about is no longer relevant for him. You cannot say that he doesn't exist. When all ways of being, all phenomena, all are removed, then all descriptions have also been removed. So you can't describe such a person. And I think it's quite a nice way of looking at also us, also the self. Can you really describe it? Can you really say it is this? When you look at it carefully, can you really say who you are, what is this self? I think I'll stop there. Thank you. So we'll take a few minutes.